We're back. It's CIUT 89.5, just like the lady said. I'm just affirming that. This is the Taylor Report. Phil, you have a program coming up tomorrow at 12 o'clock. What's happening?
Well, tomorrow is Christmas Eve, and we are going to go to the Dublin of James Joyce, and we're going to have a dramatic reading of his short story, The Dead, which will take up most of the program, and then we will also play some of the music that is mentioned and referenced in the short story, so because it's a very musical story.
Hey, that's going to be... That is...
So, and I found a recording from 1904 of an aria that it gets discussed at the supper table in The Dead. So this is... we have a wonderful reader from Ireland, Tighe Hines, who's going to read the complete story for us, and... that's tomorrow at noon, and I hope everybody will listen in.
Tomorrow at noon, 89.5 FM. Yeah. That's very special. Hey, speaking of special things in Christmas, A Child's Country Christmas by Larry Krotz. LarryKrotz.ca. He was on our program last week reading from this book, and everybody ought to have this. Even Americans should pick up a copy of this. A Child's Country Christmas. And I want to remind you, too, that a book I'm very high on, and we have had the author as a guest, was Hemingway Lives by Clancy Siegel, Why Reading Ernest Hemingway Matters Today. And I was watching people being interviewed about the death of Nelson Mandela, and two of them mentioned that they had Nelson Mandela had told them to read Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. And it's in Fidel Castro. In talking about in having met Hemingway, he said they read For Whom the Bell Tolls in the Sierra Maestra. So Clancy Siegel tells you in his book about Hemingway, Hemingway Lives, why that's something that everybody should do. We're joined now, I believe, by Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Yes, I am, Phil, and I can't agree more with Clancy Siegel about reading For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Isn't
I read it last year, just wonderful book.
Yeah, you know, this Democracy Now! Had the one of the founders of the armed movement in South Africa, and he told about meeting Nelson Mandela in 1962, and he said Mandela told him to read that, among other things.
Wow. But he said,
So it is remarkable.
Yeah.
Now, you have reprinted, and by the way, it's a lovely book. It's Baraka Books, I assume, and it's called Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. So you've retitled. Nice title.
Well, yeah, thank you. And it's updated as well. It's, you know, I'll just give some background to this book. It was a book originally written in French, and the title was Ça ne s'est pas passé comme ça à Kigali. And it was published in 2003 here in Quebec and in France, and it created quite a stir, and it got people angry, but made a lot of people very happy to see an attempt to dig into the truth and find the truth about what happened in Rwanda in the 90s. And as you know, but I'll just tell you for your listeners. I tried to find an English language publisher for quite a few years throughout North America, and nobody was interested in doing it. It was translated until the Taylor Report very gracefully agreed to
post
put up the first version of it in English on your website. And then the book, it was called Rwanda 1994, Colonialism Dies Hard, and it was on your website, and parts of it still are, as I understand. And then there were people kept insisting that it had to be brought out and updated. And one of them is Ed Herman, who you've interviewed, I think, here, on your program. Mm-hmm. And Ed was after me, to saying, you've got to put this out and update it. And so I figured that would be the time to do it would be now, as we're approaching the 20th anniversary of the assassination of two African heads of state, the president of Rwanda and of Burundi, and then with all the tragic events that followed. And the title, and one of the things that I've noticed, and I know you deal with this quite often, is what we might call a new scramble for Africa that has been developing since, I would say, for the last 10-15 years, where you have, with the reference, of course, is to the 1885 Berlin Conference, where the Europeans basically divided up Africa and were scrambling for it. And we see this happening now. And why Rwanda is because, as Max Forte says in his book on Libya, slouching towards Earth, he said, everywhere is Rwanda for the humanitarian imperialist and the humanitarian interventionist. Everywhere is Rwanda. And so you start looking at it and you say, well, when they went into Syria, into Libya in 2011, they were saying this is going to be another Rwanda. Last fall, when they were going to go, earlier this fall, were going to bomb Syria, many people just said this is another Rwanda. And just last week, Samantha Power said we have to go to Central African Republic because it's going to be like Rwanda.
Yes.
And so that's the idea.
It's an easy reference and political leverage without ever anybody looking to see what you might mean by that.
Exactly.
Ivory Coast was the same story.
Exactly. And I almost came to the conclusion that even Rwanda is not Rwanda.
No, you know? Of course.
And as to what is being used, and so so I think that the way that things are going, and maybe we could another time go over and try and figure out where you have European and American troops on the ground in Africa. It's like all over it, Africa, and so it is extremely important to see where this began. And my position, or the position I defend in this book, is that Rwanda was a turning point. It was a way in which they could justify. They talk about failed states, that they basically had failed themselves, you know, that they had failed the European and American interests that basically forced them to fail so that they could go in.
Yes.
And so that that's sort of the what I've tried to defend in this update as well as the book.
By the way, on that point, there are many economists and observers of the, you know, of this, so what we call neoliberalism now, that seems to be the word, who said that the way the European powers were addressing Africa, were dated, say, circa 1990, was going to destroy the governments and the survivability of those societies in Africa. I recall a couple of economists, I assume Michael Chostadovsky was one of them, that said,
right.
You're going to destroy these because you're taking all control away from them to manage their own economies. You're telling them that you will manage the economy.
Right, exactly.
And that happened certainly, Burundi, Rwanda, Congo.
Right.
And it's going on. The argument is, anyone who travels Africa knows, it's an angry, bitter argument in Africa today over who gets the final say over the economies of these countries,
the budget, and this happened in Rwanda between 1990 and 1994, while the RPF had invaded. The RPF in Uganda had invaded, and they called it the Structural Adjustment Program at the time.
Yes,
SAP.
Yes, yeah, I always thought that some sneaky SOB and the CIA thought of that.
Right, exactly.
One of their things was knee pad.
Yeah, down on your knee.
Yeah,
right.
And that's how the letters worked out. NPAD.
You know, like, right. They did. And you mentioned Michel Shostakovich. I had lunch with him the other day, and he was saying that he basically backed the RPF. But then, in 1996, he went, because he's an economist, he studied the books and studied the investment, and he just saw how the IMF and the World Bank were funneling money into Uganda and taking it away from Rwanda. He just saw this in the books, and so he changed his position once he saw that. He realized what was going on. So, you know.
Yes. And by the way, there has been a lot of changing and shifting. People, this thing that Samantha Powers and others, Gurevich, tried to write in stone has eroded and transformed. And many people have changed their point of view, including a gentleman we had on this program who also has a new book in English. His name is Dr. Teogen Rudasingwa.
Right.
An RPF big shot, I can't think of any other word, who seems to say what you're saying.
I just finished that book because, you know, here's a man who was with, very much a doer, an operator, and a close collaborator of Kagame's. He underlines how he says how they operate, what they wanted to do. How, you know, he has his own understanding, which I couldn't agree with. But factually, basically, he says the same things that I'm saying in his book, and it is very important. It's, in fact, I feel in some ways it's sadly vindicated because people have accused me of the worst crimes, as I think they have you as well. You know, like using words like denial and negationist and so on. Yet, if you analyze what we're saying about how these events happened, and you compare it to what this man who was working with Kagame says, basically you're saying exactly the same thing. Our interpretation may be somewhat different about who was right and who was wrong, but you know, the fact that the RPF, and if you want to go back to 94, which in my book I point out that, as you know, my starting point was Boutros Ghali's statement, and which he told me in two interviews.
Yeah, let me underline that, by the way. You spoke to two major players. Boutros Ghali, who had been the Secretary General of the United Nations in 1994.
Exactly.
And you spoke to Mr. Bobo from Cameroon, who was in charge of the United Nations operation in Rwanda. People have forgotten those names, and I don't think it's an accident that they've been erased or airbrushed.
Boutros Ghali has been erased, and he made this statement first, I think it was around 97. He said the Rwandan genocide was 100% American responsibility. And when I read that, that was when I requested an interview, and he quickly granted me the interview, and I interviewed him twice, in fact, in Paris, and he explained what they had done. He said he said because when we wanted to send people in to implement the Arusha peace agreement and to ensure that there would be a ceasefire, the Americans, with the help of the British, did everything they could to block it, and they succeeded. And he said, and basically he said that the reason was they wanted the RPF. They had sided with the RPF, with Kagame and company, to win. And so he, you know, this is what he says. Well, of course, what you see in Ruta Singh's book is he says basically that same thing, that they did not, their position was to say that the international community forgot about us. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they did not want any intervention from the UN, and they were mad as hell, in fact, when the French actually did intervene very late, in late June in 1994. So,
yes, when the outcome was decided.
The outcome was decided, and what has happened since is absolutely, nobody foresaw it, but it follows exactly the things that happened from 1994, and what we've seen going on in the Congo has been, you might say, that follows a pattern of how to operate, how to take control of that part of Central Africa. And so my feeling is that people right now who are perhaps turning on Kagame, I'm glad to see it, but in order to understand, you have to go back and understand that this started in the late 1980s.
Yes.
And the Rwandan people have been, the Rwandan people have had this terrible destruction foisted upon them.
Yeah. And by the way, by a general who was a general in the Ugandan army when he invaded in October 1990, he was a general in the Ugandan army. There were political leaders, Faustin Togeri Mungu, the prime minister, and, of course, Mr. Wegema, also prime minister, served. They weren't allowed to do be political. The general, turned out, was the master and remains the master of the whole place. We just, by the way, interviewed a woman who advocating on behalf of Victoire Ingabire, a woman who poses no military threat whatsoever.
No.
And yet she is not allowed to seek public office. And indeed, she's got a 15-year sentence, a pink costume, and had her head shaved for daring to speak to this general as though she had rights.
Exactly. And daring to do what everybody in the so-called international community wants, that is, hold elections. And so she decided to go and run in those elections. And that's something you just cannot do in that country under Kagame. You have, and that's the minute that he threatened, he just locked her up. And it's basically, it's people are silent about it.
Of course, others have lost their lives.
Absolutely.
Journalists, I recall the last election, there was a party tried to form, and they beheaded the campaign leader of the party, beheaded him.
Right.
They murdered Seth Sendashonga and others. I want to ask you, Robin, about an individual and your thoughts about it, because he's just died, is Michael Andrew Horrigan.
Right.
A wonderful piece was written about him by David Peterson, who works with Ed Herman, does brilliant work, founded Zed Communications.
Right. And co-authored of the book, The Politics of Genocide, an extremely
brilliant,
important book.
A brilliant book, Politics for Grown-Ups, I'd call that, as opposed to other people. Michael Horrigan was, tell us about him and what are your thoughts about him. It's a great loss, is it not?
Yeah, Michael Horrigan, he's somebody who believed in the international criminal justice, and he was hired as an investigator. He was working and he was proud to be in that, doing that. He believed the what you might call official story. He was working under the prosecutor, chief prosecutor first, Goldstone, but then Louise Arbour mainly. And he had several lists of things he had to do. And he arrested Bagosora, who was supposedly the brains behind what they called a genocide, and several others. And then the other job he had to do was to investigate the shooting down on April 6th, 1994, of the president's plane, the president Habyarimana's plane, in which there were
the event
people.
That triggered the fighting and massacres.
Exactly, and so he started going in there because at this time, and I, if you want, at the end, I would like to say something about the tribunal that you know very well, but that I've added to this book, but. Michael Horrigan went in there with total honesty. There, at that point, the tribunal was operating on the narrative that the extremists on the government, on the president's side, had shot down the plane in order to be the signal that they could start killing Tutsi. And so the tribunal was looking to prove, to make that statement. So he goes there with a very competent investigators. And what does he find out? He finds out that the RPF was behind it. In fact, he finds credible witnesses who make statements saying this is how it happened, where it happened, and who did it. And at first, Louise Arbour was very enthusiastic about it, and then she was up in The Hague in Holland, and at a certain point, Michael Horrigan was summoned to The Hague, where he met Louise Arbour, and Louise Arbour said, stop doing that, give me all the information, all the papers you have, and that's no longer our mandate. And a complete change of policy. And Michael Horrigan, basically, they told him to walk. In other words, he basically said, it's finished your career with us. Mm-hmm. And, so here he was. Here's a man who went in there, who was basically on there, side in this issue. He goes to look for truth.
Yes.
He finds truth, and then they say, no, we don't want to know the truth. And the world does not deserve to know it. And here you have the worst terrorist act in the 1990s. I think we could say that quite two heads of state assassinated.
Certainly in terms of its consequences, yes.
Yeah, and also in seriousness, because I was trying to think about other terrorist attacks in the 1990s of that magnitude, of that importance, And they decide that the so-called international community decide it's not important enough. It's not included in our mandate. Mm-hmm. And so Michael did that. And then Michael, I know that in his, he kept going forward. And mm-hmm. he kept to his guns. And he made his statements, he made them official yes. statements, affidavits that are now available and, yes. and are still available. And
it's
anyway,
in the congressional record as well, by the way.
Yeah.
Him and it is and a colleague, James Lyons, former of the American FBI, who agreed with him.
Right. Exactly.
They complimented each other's points.
Right, exactly. Now, in this book that I've just brought out, Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, I've rewritten the whole section on the ICTR because I decided to read one of the books written. You know, in the United States, they have these people, when they want to advance in politics, they write a book about how good they were. Mm-hmm. And this guy, David Sheffer, who was their ambassador at large for war crimes issues, and he wrote this this big, long book about war, all the... I can't remember the title of it. And he described what the goals of the tribunals were. And if you allow me, he was talking about the ICTY, which is the ex-Yugoslav tribunal, but they're basically the same tribunal. And if you allow me to quote it, he says, "By then the tribunal was a potent judicial tool, and I had enough support from President Clinton, Secretary of State Albright, Secretary of Defense Cohen, and other top officials in Washington," and he says, "to wield it like a battering ram in the execution of U.S. and NATO policy." This is their wow. official...
And that's in your book.
That's in the book.
We're going to make that our quote of the year. We'll read that a lot.
Yeah, no, because there are people who pretend this international justice, there's something to it. But here... the guy who's basically responsible for it, the key man under the Clinton administration and after, by the way, says now it was going to be a battering ram in the pursuit, execution of U.S. and NATO policy.
Mm-mm. We're looking at you, Libya.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Max Forte must think. Look at that and see. That would have to be a popular quote with Max Forte.
I'm sure it will. I'm sure it is. And the thing is I think you once said to me, and I'll repeat it. I said, "Oh, that I would that my enemy would write a book,
yeah,
or something like that."
Yes, that's a famous. That's not original. Yes.
No, but it's true. You know,
it does help.
Sometimes you go back and see this guy, a long book, self-aggrandizing book, but then he describes how the administration perceived the tribunal, justice. Forget about it. So.
Yeah. Well, it's great to talk to you about it. The book, mm-hmm. This is Robin Philpott. The book is Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. It's Baraka Books, and I hope anybody who wants to talk about Rwanda has to have this book. So, Robin, thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. Bye-bye. It just almost wraps it up.
Yeah, Phil, can we remind our listeners that we had Michael Hourigan as a guest on Taylor Report at least
that's
twice.
Right. By the way, if you go to taylor-report.com, our interviews with Michael Hourigan are there. And as he points out to us, very few people called him and wanted to know about his experience because his comments destroyed a whole library full of bunk about what happened in Rwanda. Just his affidavit alone did that. And his interview with us, quite candid. He was a sparkling personality, very strong guy. By the way, he was only 55 years old. Very, very unfortunate. And do get the article by David Peterson, Michael Andrew Hourigan, and it's a Zed Communications. If you just put actually David Peterson's name and Michael Hourigan, it will, of course, come up. Last thing I want to tell you that, of course, we're going to wish you all have nice holidays and all that. But to remind you why you listen to the Taylor Report and why you listen to Alternative Radio or CIUT, I see a headline here. It says, "Politics, not in a freed Russian tycoon's agenda." And they're telling us the story of Michael Khodorkovsky, and they keep calling him a tycoon. He's a thief, actually. And he was convicted in court. They don't mention. And the European court looked at the case and said, yes, he stole and he's convicted properly. And for the kind of stealing he did, you spend a lot longer in jail than he spent. But the Toronto Star manages to fill a whole half a page practically talking about how he dresses well and how cool he looks and he's a daring blah, blah. A guy named Yeltsin said, I'm going to give you an oil company and you're going to get rich and give me 10%. And that's what happened. And Yeltsin's figures, and if you want to rate him, he's less than 2% approval. He's down there at the bottom with Valenza of Poland, who's hovering around 1%. All these guys were so celebrated by Reagan, Thatcher, Clinton, Pakistan. This guy, Khodorkovsky, has got to be called a thief. Not a tycoon. A tycoon has talent. I mean, it doesn't take any talent to steal, particularly if somebody gives you the job. Anyway, that's why you're listening, I assume, to Taylor Report. CIUT 89.5 FM. And have a nice holiday. We'll see you.